for AntiWar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is AntiWar Radio. It turns out that my guest on the show right now, Barrett Brown, writes for The Onion. Welcome to the show, Barrett. How are you doing?
Very well. How are you doing?
I appreciate you sitting on hold and being patient with me there. I always thought that The Onion headline on the Oklahoma City bombing should have been Americans buy lone bomber scenario, hook, line, and sinker. And then the whole article could be about how we all just forgot that there ever was a John Doe number two and all that, huh?
They try to be more subtle than that, I think, you know.
Yeah, actually, their headline about the Oklahoma bombing was angel sightings are on the rise in Oklahoma. Anyway.
Oh, no, it was after McVeigh was executed, man. There was thousands of angels floating up into the air that are over Oklahoma City or some such. You know.
All right. Anyway, so, yeah, let's change the subject to something contemporary here, which is WikiLeaks, a very important website, and there's very important news about it. I guess first let me finish doing your introduction here. Ooh, and I hope we can actually talk about this toward the end of the interview, because this is something fun to me. The book, which I haven't read yet, but I want to, is called Flock of Dodos, Behind Modern Creationism, Intelligent Design, and the Easter Bunny. That sounds like fun.
It was a lot of fun, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. And then Hot, Fat, and Clouded is coming out this year. Barrett Brown also writes for Vanity Fair, The Huffington Post, Skeptic, and The Onion. So there's your bio there. Now, tell us, what is WikiLeaks, and what's so important about it this week?
WikiLeaks has become one of the most crucial methods by which previously classified or otherwise secret information, both from government bodies and non-government bodies, can be taken by a whistleblower, given to someone that they will have confidence in, will have a method of distributing that information, and will do so in a manner that protects the anonymity of the leaker in question, and really making sure that as many people as possible have access to information. And it's been around for a number of years. They've broken a number of important scoops regarding Guantanamo Bay when they printed an older version of the Guantanamo procedural manual that was used down there just to embody the regulations used day-to-day at Guantanamo. More recently, they've done a lot regarding the Icelandic banking crisis and certain negotiations that are ongoing regarding getting everyone's credit back in line in terms of nation-states. They're constantly putting out new information. Oftentimes, it'll be thousands and thousands of pages of data that has to be sort of looked through for anything that might be of particular interest. And, you know, it starts with always raising money. They need money for legal fees, for server costs, that kind of thing. And this would be a good time to donate in light of what's been going on.
Yeah. Well, actually, let's hold what's been going on for just a second, because I want to chime in here and just say this is really the Internet at its best. I mean, this is where any Daniel Ellsberg now, he doesn't have to convince the Times to finally run the damn thing. He can just send it to WikiLeaks. This is the only kind of good rat in our whole society is a government employee who's ratting on his boss and giving up documents that the American people need to see. And that's what this website is all about.
Absolutely. And I mean, and to the extent that one sees the inside the media, you know, working in the media some capacity, one sees sort of the structures that have developed that really prevent it from fulfilling the functions that it may have been able to fill decades ago, or really that have never been able to fill, but could. I mean, for instance, there's a lot of individuals working in the media. Each of them have their own life going on. They have their own emphases. They have their own roles in the structure. You have an editor who may or may not be interested in running a piece, maybe of importance, but for some reason or other that he just doesn't think it's going to be in his best interest to run it. It may seem too conspiratorial. It may not have a good timeliness. So it could be something simple as that. There's a lot of reasons why mainstream outlets, including some of the ones I write for, just aren't in a position to put out the kind of information that WikiLeaks and other institutions that have developed on the Internet are able to do every day.
In fact, the Washington Post, I'm sorry, I can't remember the context, but I can remember the context. It was this article about how the Durham investigation into the torture and the Durham investigation into the destruction of the CIA tapes. They had a paragraph in there, a short one, that just said, the Washington Post has been asked to not reveal the man's name due to et cetera, et cetera. And that's the kind of thing that it's always been that way, right? Where the Washington Post, going back to the Watergate or whatever, if the government calls up the Washington Post and says, we really want you to sit on this, they will. They sat on, New York Times sat on the Rice and Lichblau NSA spying story for more than a year.
Yeah, again, I mean, there's a lot of ins and outs there. There's a lot of individuals who are willing to take those kinds of records from the government for various reasons, either because they do believe it's in the national interest or because just personally they don't want to be the one to, you know, to upset certain people, higher ups, even at the publication or in the government. I mean, there's just a lot of structural deficits right now.
Mm-hmm.
There always have been, really, but particularly now, that prevent the media from being anywhere near what it could be in terms of informing the public.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm looking at your article at True Slant right now, and it seems like all this competition would force them to get better, but I guess they've just ceded all the real journalism to the Internet.
Yeah, I mean, and that's probably the best, because the Internet has certain advantages just structurally that even beyond the mentalities of people involved in the respective mediums of traditional media and Internet, there's just things as simple as hyperlinking. I mean, the existence of hyperlinks on people of my generation have really made it such that we want to see primary sources if someone makes an assertion. If someone's talking about something that happened in the past on a blog, we expect to see and do see a link back to the raw material. And that's something that was not capable in the printing press age. I mean, you would have references in the back, you know, footnotes, end notes, those kind of things, and you could go through the library, presumably, if you're so inclined, and look up and make absolutely sure that everything's in context. But that would have been either improbable or impossible in some cases. I think the fact that we are able to check into primary sources at a fundamentally increased degree right now is one of the things that we should be thinking more about. I think it's one of the great advantages of our age that has not really been looked into to the degree that it should.
Right. Well, this is how I first came to love antiwar.com. It took me about 2 seconds. I looked, and all it was 200 or 300 links back in 1999 or something. And then I read my first Justin Raimondo column, and he had 50 links to all the proof of all his assertions all throughout the article, too. And I clicked the links, and it was good stuff. And that was kind of not just the magic of antiwar.com, but the magic of the Internet entirely. In fact, sometimes in a Raimondo column, the link will simply be to a Google search for a certain term, and then just to set you off going your own direction. Or, you know, I think that's how I learned you can do search site for just this one site for faster, please, at nationalreview.org. Or, you know what I mean? You're right. I mean, I'm just trying to agree with you. I think the Internet, I guess the problem is people still watch TV news, and they haven't really, the consumer hasn't fully made the transition yet, but we're working on it.
Well, you see demographics, you see there's a large difference. Older people, of course, can be more likely to watch TV news, and particularly some of the really lesser instances of TV news like Fox News. People who are younger, who are just fundamentally more inclined to be using the Internet, as such, are going to have a greater degree of erudition than these older people. What you have been as a result is a generation that may be perhaps better adapted to understanding the world around them, because they have they've grown up with this increased array of information, this increased accessibility. Some of them active on it growing up, some of them have taken advantage of this. And I mean, for the first time, and for to an extent never seen before in human history, people today who choose to do so have access to an array of knowledge, past and present, absolutely incomparable to anything that's ever existed before. So that's something that's worth thinking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, toward the end of this thing, I guess I'd like to get back to the question of, you know, how you see what's happening this week with WikiLeaks in terms of, you know, indications of trends we need to be wary of in terms of the Internet. There have been, you know, reports about Obama executive orders about, you know, in certain national emergencies being able to seize control of it and this and that. But I guess, you know, let's get to the particulars of the news this week. Again, I'm talking with Barrett Brown from True Slant. It's TrueSlant.com. And the article is CIA, State Department, apparently acting on plan to destroy WikiLeaks, the website we've been talking about here. Now, what are they doing to destroy WikiLeaks, Barrett?
Well, first I should specify that there's two plans we're talking about. One is the plan that was concocted in 2008 and which was just made available on the 15th of this month by WikiLeaks, which apparently had a mole within the Army Intelligence Division, the Cyber Intelligence Division within that, which leaks the document in question to WikiLeaks. The document talks about WikiLeaks holdings. It's a very long document providing sort of a summary of what WikiLeaks is, what the intent of its founders is, what the dynamics are behind WikiLeaks, what it does, what its effects are, and specifically what threat it may pose to operations conducted by the Army and other military branches of the U.S. government. And within that document, they propose marginalizing WikiLeaks or lowering its degree of power. They use the term center of gravity, interestingly enough. They refer to it as a center of gravity for leaked documents for previously undisclosed information. They talk about reducing it as a center of gravity by going after leakers, having them fired, criminally prosecuted, and otherwise arrested, which is not a particularly original tactic. I mean, that's something you would think they would all already be, that would be their position already. I mean, generally, these leakers in question are violating the employment guidelines by leaking information to this board. Sometimes they are actually violating the law to some extent. But what's that? The other plan, I guess you could call it, that's been enacted this week, apparently, according to messages deployed by WikiLeaks 2 evenings ago, apparently involves a joint operation between U.S. intelligence services, the State Department at least, and possibly the CIA, and also the Icelandic intelligence services. And you probably don't hear the term Icelandic intelligence services very often.
Yeah, I think that might be the first time I've ever heard of it.
Right. It didn't come up very often, but in this case it did, at least according to WikiLeaks. But anyway, so they're saying that over the last couple of days, they were the target of, quote, an aggressive intelligence operation, unquote, by these entities. Apparently, their main editor was in Iceland at some point to assist with legislation being proposed in Iceland that would basically make Iceland a safe haven for information that might be considered illegal elsewhere in the world, which, of course, that's something of great interest to every government on the planet. They say they were being tailed, that one person was detained for 22 hours, that they were shown pictures of their production photos, production meetings, that they were asked specific questions during the detention related to the videos they say they have, which they've encrypted or de-encrypted, and which they'll be putting up on April 5th, which apparently depicts an airstrike performed by the U.S. government in January, which appears to have killed a number of journalists and civilians, and which was presumably covered up to some extent afterwards, perhaps blamed on another entity. So just to summarize, I mean, they have editors who have been traveling lately between Norway and Iceland and elsewhere, and who have been tailed by people on the State Department diplomatic cover, and people being detained, some computers being seized. There's no more information about that. I'm going to assume it's one of their computers. They've been shown that they've been recorded in some respect. They've been apparently have been photographed at their production meetings unknowingly to them at the time, and been shown those photos recently.
Now, let me ask you just about those pictures real quick. Is there any indication what angle these pictures are from? They're from, you know, outside people showing up at the meeting, or they have a rat on the inside of their board there, or what?
There's no indication of that. The only information we have from them at this point is this Twitter message that says, quote, "We have been shown secret photos of our production meetings and been asked specific questions during detention related to the airstrike," unquote. The airstrike being a reference to the video they have, that they said they've decrypted, you know. So we don't know anything more about how those, the nature of those photos may be, where they may have been taken from, if they are pictures of people arriving at a meeting with their photos. I would be surprised if their photos taken from inside a room by someone in there. I would imagine WikiLeaks folks are recruited, you know, from people who are pretty hardcore into information freedom. If in fact there's some mole in WikiLeaks itself, that would obviously be you know, problematic. You know, we would expect to, that would be problematic. Basically, I'll just put it that way.
Well, and now, what can you tell me about this airstrike? This was in Afghanistan, and some journalists got killed, or what?
Well, we don't know where it was. January, which is when the airstrike apparently occurred, according to them, that month had an unusual high number of airstrikes by the U.S. government in Waziristan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. So it could be in Pakistan, it could be in Afghanistan. Those are the most likely locations for any such airstrike that could have gone wrong and killed civilians. This happens all the time. I mean, there's been a number of incidents in which very large numbers of civilians have been killed by predator drones or otherwise. Oftentimes when a Taliban or some sort of Afghani insurgent leader is expected to be, you know, at a location for a wedding or some such, he doesn't show up, or he is there and they kill him, and they kill a bunch of partygoers along with him. I mean, that happens, routinely. My best estimation after having talked to people about this, see, people with no particular knowledge of this actual video, but it's people whose opinions I trust on these matters. The best estimation I can come up with right now is there's probably a predator drone that fired on some location where some alleged al-Qaeda member was supposed to be, which accidentally killed some journalists and civilians instead, and which was probably perhaps blamed on some other source altogether, you know, perhaps suicide bombings and such. So, I mean, that's what I would guess at this point, you know. But again, this is not based on any information I have that no one else has. This is simply based on what WikiLeaks themselves have put out. And they put out a lot of, you know, just sort of not entirely useful, very short bursts of information regarding this video. So you have to kind of piece it together from what they've said.
Yeah, their Twitter feed is, I guess.
Interestingly enough, on their Twitter feed, there was a message that appeared as taken down yesterday, which said something about it being a Pentagon strike, or the Pentagon video. Now, of course, one would expect the Pentagon to be an umbrella term you could use for this video, simply because of what's going on with everything else. But for some reason, they took that down. So I'm not sure what that should indicate. The message that, you know, taken down was WikiLeaks to reveal Pentagon murder cover-up at U.S. National Press Club, April 5th. And that's a reference to, I guess they've organized or are trying to organize a presentation of the video on April 5th at the U.S. National Press Club.
Yeah, coming up April 5th, it says. Well, now, I'm kind of confused because, I guess I understand that the laws are different and that the CIA and the State Department can twist any arms of any intelligence agency anywhere they want and that kind of thing, but I sort of thought that the nature of the Internet meant that it doesn't matter whether you're in Iceland or in Sweden or wherever, you can have mirrors of all your files all over the place wherever you want, more than the cops could ever keep up with, right? I mean, is it really as simple as stealing some of their computers and then the information's gone?
Well, there's two sort of landscapes we're looking at. We're looking at what is done and can be done, and then what international law and national laws say. In this case, I mean, just look at the example of WikiLeaks in particular. In 2009, a German fellow who owned the German WikiLeaks domain name, his home was raided by German police. This was shortly after they had published some documents stolen, I think, from the Australian government. And probably the raid was done at the behest of Australia. You have to understand, and I'm sure you do understand, that intelligence services, even to the extent that they are in opposition to some extent, just to the extent that they're competing, even with that, they have certain common interests, just by way of mentality or by way of actual practicality in terms of, you know, what they're trying to do for their respective countries. One of those things is matters of encryption. They're not real fond of there being, civilian access to very high-end encryption techniques. They're also not fond of people having access to decryption techniques that would be relevant to their encryption techniques. That's just an example. But just in general, on the whole, there is a sort of mentality that one develops to the extent that one is at the center of, secrecy and power. And that's a shared mentality. And that people like that have certain things in common with others, no matter who they may be and no matter how much they may have, no matter how much contradictory spheres of influence they may have, no matter how much they may be in competition on a day-to-day basis. Overall, I mean, there's a certain shared mentality, and that gets acted upon. And that's why, perhaps the U.S. intelligence service in this case did twist the arms of, say, the Icelandics, or perhaps the Australians did twist the arms of the Germans. More likely, they were happy to oblige. That's just the nature of the game.
Now, I'm only like a, level 2 computer dork or something. I can make the windows go, but I can't really work it from the inside like a lot of these geniuses can. And I'm pretty ignorant, really, about the architecture of the Internet and that kind of thing. I guess the last real computer genius I had on the show kind of debunked my understanding, my overly simplistic understanding that there were so few routers that basically, if the government determined to do so, that they could basically seize the Internet with force. And by, occupying the proper switches at AT&T headquarters and that kind of thing. And forget the young man's name who came on the show to set me straight about that, who said that the Internet is just too widespread and it's too interconnected and there's too many separate servers all over the place that ultimately, no matter what any national government wants, they can't really control the Internet. It's too late for them now. It's the genie is out of the bottle. No government can ever undo this thing. And yet we do see news stories and headlines from time to time about how people inside the government would like to try, and they'll call it whatever they want about, obscenity or whatever it is, WikiLeaks. But it seems like they would like to control it. Can you, fill me in with any details about what kind of danger there is of the Internet changing from the kind of free, anarchic, first-come-first-serve sort of system that it is now to something, much more, under the control of the police?
Well, aside from the question of regarding the extent to which national governments could seize control of parts of the Internet, what we do know and what we see every day is that certain national governments, would very much love to and have enacted in certain ways to do so. I mean, we have China with its great firewall, which they've implemented in the past few years and which has been reasonably successful in making it very, very difficult for the average Chinese person to get access to information that he otherwise would be able to access. There are various ways around what they have right now. They'll keep improving it. Just as a side note, Thomas Friedman, who is considered the nation's most respectable columnist, wrote a long column on China back in 2001, I believe, on China. One of the myths he busted was that China was going to crack down on the Internet, and he said, "No, they know they can't do that. They're not going to bother." And of course, they did. That's one of my pet issues. The failures of our national columnists and being competent in the things they choose to talk about. You have China, of course, has done that. You have, North Korea. I mean, it's just various nations that already have a tendency to do these sort of things have, of course, done them. And here in the U.S., you have various murmurings, just about the dangers, real or imagined, the Internet presents. And you have, you almost certainly, based on this document, which we'll talk about in a bit, I think, the leaked Army cyber intel document, they're thinking about these things. I mean, they understand that there are, that they have A, legitimate concerns about the Internet's anarchic nature, and B, concerns that we would call illegitimate in terms of, the ability to control populations in order to, enforce a top-down sort of vision for humanity, in which governments are often, to some degree or another, in the habit of engaging in. So we know that there's a lot of things going on in that regard. We know that there's a lot of governments that have enacted what they hope to be, steps to censor the Internet. We know that there are those within other bigger governments that would like to do take similar measures. And unfortunately, you know, in free governments, those will always come under the rubric of things like, you know, law and order. It's basically generally the sort of the umbrella proximate cause of whatever they'll choose to enact. In this case, child pornography is often cited as something that for which they require more and greater controls in order to counteract. So most likely what you'll see at some point is more discussion of, you know, the Internet as an incubator for terrorism, more discussion of the Internet as a purveyor of child pornography, those kind of things, hot-button deals that can get attention. And then they'll use those, as they often do, as a means by which to restrict Internet access. Now, the question is, can they do that? Will they be successful in that? There's no certain answer to that, and that's going to depend on how citizens react to those measures. It's going to depend not just on the sort of the larger trends, but also on individuals coalescing and coordinating in manners provided for by the Internet in such a way as to counteract these things, bring attention to these potential problems of censorship, and to fight them directly.
Well, I like to believe that the genie's just out of the bottle. I mean, ultimately, these computers were made by them for keeping track of us. And in the double-edged sword fashion, we found our way to use it back against them. And they hate it. I mean, I'm sure you noticed the thing a couple of months back about Cass Sunstein, who wrote that thing. I forgot his official position or if he's got one, but he's one of the Obama lawyers, I think. And he wrote this whole paper about how government has got to get engaged on the Internet and debunk people who say bad things about the government, whatever it is. And, of course, that just became the biggest story of the week that people were citing and talking bad about the government. You know what I mean? It's too late for them. Cass Sunstein and all of his, undercover comment section writers cannot undo what they've already done.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not entirely sure. I don't know technically the answer to that question, you know, the overall question there of what they can do in terms of comprehensively, you know, taking over the Internet. I think that would probably be a large endeavor, even aside from the public relations in the back on all the preparation necessary. I mean, let's say there was some major international disaster and for some reason it was, you know, agreeable to the public to have the Internet be seized control of by various governments. I don't know to what extent that would even be possible under those circumstances. That's a question you have to put to, and it sounds like you've spoken to someone who may have had a firm opinion on that regarding the genie already having been let out of the bottle. I don't know. I hope that's the case. I hope it is the case that the actual physical nature of the Internet is such that it's basically impossible to be deterred at this point.
But yeah, at least that's looking on the bright side.
Yeah, well, I try not to look on the bright side. I try to look at the most pessimistic outcomes.
Oh, then you need James Bamford, The Shadow Factory. Have you read that one?
I have not, no.
Oh, yeah. Well, that goes next on your list there, Barrett. It's about how the National Security Agency basically downloads the entire Internet all day, every day. And, in fact, it was just in the news not too long ago, maybe a month or two ago, that they're working on or finishing up the new facility, new National Security Agency facility in San Antonio that's roughly the size of the Alamo Dome, which is huge because I've been at Ozfest there and it's gigantic. They know how to rock in San Antonio. But anyway, it's a mile or so away from the brand new Microsoft headquarters. And basically they're measuring the amount of data that they can hold there in the petaflops and yottaflops and they have the capacity to store everything ever published by humanity in, you know, a tenth of the space that they have there. And so maybe they can't stop us, but they sure as hell can watch everything we do. And they have the software to supposedly, you know, make sense out of it all, too.
Well, again, and to the extent that's the case, that makes encryption, civilian access to encryption all the more important because, they are worried about encryption. That's why certain encryption codes are illegal. I actually have a friend of mine who I collaborate with on certain projects who actually has a tattoo of this illegal encryption code on his arm, such that he has basically made himself an illegal entity in the eyes of the government by virtue of having this particular little code on him. It's a very short code. I think it's probably under 50 characters, but it's apparently, currently, unbreakable in a reasonable viable method of keeping things encrypted. And to the extent the government is going to pursue its natural tendencies to keep tabs on things, civilians have to pursue their natural tendencies, their natural and very reasonable aspirations to keep those things concealed. The alternative is a situation in which, you know, the government is always is the last word. And looking back at human history, we probably don't want the government to be the last word. We have a very bad track record in setting up and maintaining our governments in such a way as would be conducive to humanity's aspirations in general. So, you know, let's keep things under wraps to the extent that we can.
Everybody, I'm talking with Barrett Brown from TrueSlant.com, and I have to ask you about this. The book, it says here, is Flock of Dodos, Behind Modern Creationism, Intelligent Design, and the Easter Bunny. And so I wonder, do you prove in there then that all the geologists in the world are part of a communist conspiracy to lie about how old the Earth is?
Yes. It wasn't hard either.
It was hard. You just add up all the ages from Adam and Eve, and then you're done, right?
No, I just figured, hey, you know, this could potentially be used by Marxist biological materialists to prove their theories, and thus that's what they were there for. That's what the intention was. You know, it's just natural logic. Even though, you know, with ironically enough, you know, there is obviously, I get a lot of, you know, having been sort of a part of that debate a number of years ago, you get a lot of accusations regarding this being a communist conspiracy of, you know, evolution. The funny thing is the Soviets, banned Darwin. They banned the reasonable, theory of evolution as, you know, originated by Darwin, replaced it with Lamarckism, which is bizarre, totally unscientific variant on it, because they didn't think that the theory of evolution as proposed by Darwin was conducive to communist theory, to Marxist theory. I'm not sure what their reasoning was exactly, but they seemed to think it was pretty reasonable. And thus it was that, you know, Soviets weren't Darwinists. So that's something that, I don't know how many creationist listeners you have, probably 3 or 4. Just be sure to tell them that's the case, and they can they don't need to worry about the Soviets and the Marxists having perpetuated evolutionary theory.
Yeah.
The person who perpetuated evolutionary theory was a guy who was studying for seminary before he did it. That was Darwin. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he was in seminary at the wrong kind of religion somewhere or something. Anyway.
Don't forget Gregor Mendel, of course, who was a monk.
This is the thing too, I'm all for people having a lot of differences of opinion on a lot of things. And in fact, if people want to try to poke holes in evolutionary theory and say, well, they need better proof of the punctuated equilibrium or whatever the hell it is, I guess that's fine. But what really bothers me is that, it's like medievalism or something. It's like we live in Iran where, you know, never mind the facts, we have this theology that overrides everything. And, I don't know, man. It's like that Carl Sagan thing about, the candle in the darkness that is the Enlightenment and the scientific process and the assumption, I guess, that human beings are reasonable and can use their brains to know things.
The Demon Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark, which came out in the late 90s by Carl Sagan.
Yeah. And, you know, this is America, and we are founded on the Enlightenment principles of, individualism and reason. You know, that's the whole idea of our society, was that people are basically capable of figuring out what's right for themselves and living their own lives and whatever. It's the very basis, is the presumption that it's okay to use reason to know things. And yet there really are parts of our society that just see that as the most cynical attempt to destroy their beliefs or something, and then so it's like a reactionary thing where then they're like mad at science at all, you know, like it's all out to get them somehow.
Yeah, one of the unfortunate deficits of what you might view conspiratism, you know, sort of a almost religious dedication to conspiracies, is that people such as, like, you know, evangelical Christians see any scientific theory that runs contrary to the belief as intentionally put forth against them. When in fact, obviously, the average research scientist is not thinking about the implications for theology when he does his research. He's trying to accomplish something, and he does accomplish something, which is quite a bit apart from what the priests do. The theory of evolution is one of those few things that I think really that's something you either ascribe to, you know, respect to, or you don't. And I have nothing more to say to you. I mean, that's because there's many, many different opinions one can have about history and the meaning of things and general trends, that sort of thing. Theory of evolution is one of those very few things that, you know, I would basically just require someone to ascribe to in order to corroborate with me on something. I'm actually setting up a project right now, and that's one of the few litmus tests. I mean, it's really one of the two litmus tests, that and gay marriage, simply because I find the people who don't ascribe to theory of evolution or who are opposed to gay marriage, I think that's a pretty easy way of filtering out people who aren't going to be very intellectually honest or perceptive or knowledgeable of history and the human condition. It's just one of those deal breakers, and it should be.
Yeah.
The theory of evolution, of course, being the most one of the most supported pieces of science that we have.
Well, you know, I guess I really shouldn't fret too much about this because, after all, I mean, well, the whole first part of our conversation is about science in action. I mean, the fact that you and I are having this conversation on the telephone and then it's going over the internet and then going out on the radio and getting, you know, automatically archived in 15 places and people in Japan are listening live right now and all these things just goes to show that science ain't going anywhere. I mean, this is our entire global economy and all our societies, however you want to define them or differentiate them, are completely dependent on this for our division of labor. Francis Bacon and all that isn't going away. It's all saved on the National Security Agency's hard drives forever. You know, so the craziest of the Christians can't really screw that up.
They had before to some extent, about 100 years ago, to some extent. And of course, you know, yes, we've made a lot of advancements, and that's wonderful, and I'm very much in favor of that. We have to remember that we also have to take advantage of everything we have. For instance, you know, it is quite wondrous, you know, I'm talking to you from here, from Brooklyn, and you're in Austin, and someone else listening to Japan, having the words having transferred over several mediums in the space of a couple seconds. But I'm sitting here in my apartment, laying on the couch, prone, wearing dirty clothes. I'm not taking full advantage of the washing machines that are available to just down the street, which is why my socks are dirty. I think I'm going to wear these jeans for about a week or so. that's a good metaphor for what I think is going on the internet. We've seen over the past 10 years how much better the internet could be as a means of disseminating information, of collaboration. We've seen this from the internet 10 years ago compared to today, what we have now. All of these new means via YouTube, et cetera, where you can have a video be made public across the world without any filter within 10 minutes. Extrapolating from that, we can probably determine that we have a long way to go in what we can achieve. So perhaps we can speed this process up if we were to spend more time thinking about what we can do with the tools available to us now, how we can better organize the people we have around us that we have access to now, what clever new methods we can devise of making that collaboration more effective. And I'd like to talk a little bit more later about a project I'm putting together called Project PM, which is designed with that in mind, which is designed as a means by which to counteract the deficits we see in the media, which in turn I think you can point to as the fundamental cause of a lot of our problems, in so much as that human society, human interaction is fueled by information and only operates positively to the extent that it receives accurate information, relevant information. I think that the media theory, I think the structures of the media is something that we're not giving enough emphasis to right now. I think it's very fundamental, and I think it's something that we need to spend a lot more time on over the next few years because other people are spending time on it. The Army Intel agencies spending time on it. Intelligence agencies all across the world spending time on it. They're looking into what's going on the internet. They're analyzing it. They're trying to figure out to what extent they can make it work for them. Likewise, we as people who try to be aware of what's going on around us, people who feel the need and the duty to act in some way, I think we need to spend a little bit more time than we are right now considering our possibilities and perhaps even acting on them.
Right on. Everybody, that's Barrett Brown. You can find what he writes at TrueSlant.com. His book is Flock of Dodos, Behind Modern Creationism, Intelligent Design, and the Easter Bunny. And please go and check out this blog entry, CIA, State Department, apparently acting on plan to destroy WikiLeaks. Thanks very much for your time on the show today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.